Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Philosophy with Dr. McDonald. In this episode, I'll be reading and discussing the section The Intoxicated Song, sections 1 to 6 in Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. And since we're coming towards the end of Zarathustra, it would be great to get some suggestions for what to read that we can dedicate perhaps an episode or a few episodes to. And the email to send those suggestions into is dissectingphilosophy@gmail.com. So let's get started with this week's section. The Intoxicated Song. Section 1. Meanwhile, however, one after another had gone out into the open air and the cool, thoughtful night. But Zarathustra himself led the ugliest man by the hand to show him his nocturnal world and the big, round moon and the silver waterfalls beside his cave. There at last they stood silently together, just a group of old folk, but with comforted, brave hearts, and amazed in themselves it was so well with them on earth. But the mystery of the night drew nearer and nearer their hearts. And Zarathustra thought to himself again, "Oh, how well they please me now, these higher men." But he did not say it, for he respected their happiness and their silence. Then, however, occurred the most astonishing thing in that long, astonishing day. The ugliest man began once more, and for the last time, to gurgle and snort. And when he at last came to the point of speech, behold, a question leaped round and pure from his mouth, a good, deep, clear question, which moved the hearts of all who heard it. "My assembled friends," said the ugliest man, "what do you think? For the sake of this day, I am content for the first time to have lived my whole life. And it is not enough that I testify only this much. It is worthwhile to live on earth. One day, one festival with Zarathustra has taught me to love the earth. Was that life? I say to death, very well, once more. My dear friends, what do you think? Will you not, like me, say to death, was that life? For Zarathustra's sake, very well, once more." Thus spoke the ugliest man, and it was not long before midnight. And what would you think then took place? As soon as the higher man had heard his question, they were all at once conscious of their transformation and recovery, and of who had given them these things. Then they leaped towards Zarathustra, thanking, adoring, caressing, kissing his hands, each after his own fashion, so that some laughed, some wept. The old prophet, however, danced with pleasure, and even if he was full of sweet wine, as some narrators believe, he was certainly fuller still of sweet life, and had renounced all weariness. There are even those who tell that the ass danced at that time. For not in vain had the ugliest man given it wine to drink. This may be the case, or it may be otherwise. And if in truth the ass did not dance that evening, greater and stranger marvels than the dancing of an ass occurred. In brief, as Zarathustra's saying has it, what does it matter? Section 2. Zarathustra, however, when this incident with the ugliest man occurred, stood there like one intoxicated. His eyes grew dim, his tongue stammered, his feet tottered, and who could divine what thoughts then passed over Zarathustra's soul? But it seemed that his soul fell back and fled before him, and was in remote distances, and as if upon a high ridge. As it is written, wandering like a heavy cloud between past and future. But gradually, while the higher men were holding him in their arms, he came to himself a little, and his hands restrained the adoring and anxious throng. Yet he did not speak. All at once, however, he swiftly turned his head, for he seemed to hear something. Then he laid a finger to his lips and said, "Come." And at once it grew still and mysterious all around. From the depths, however, there slowly arose the sound of a bell. Zarathustra listened to it, as the higher man did. Then he laid a finger to his lips a second time and said again, "Come, come, midnight is coming on." And his voice altered. But he did not move from his place. Then it grew yet more still and mysterious, and everything listened, even the ass and Zarathustra's animals of honor, the eagle and the serpent. Likewise, Zarathustra's cave and the great cool moon and the night itself. Zarathustra, however, laid his hand to his lips and for the third time said, "Come, come, come, let us walk now. The hour has come. Let us walk into the night." So we have then the intoxicated song. And it's always good to have a little brief recap of what's happened and how do we get here in the story. So then, we've had in part 4, Zarathustra go around and have a discussion with various different characters, and then at the end of each section, each character would go to Zarathustra's cave. And then we had, of course, Zarathustra come back to his cave, where you have then all these different characters that he had a chat to. And in the section a couple episodes ago, The Awakening, we had a moment in which the characters all had this sense of enlightenment, or as it said, awakening. And that was the point in which we had this whole emphasis upon a pure creative moment in which you have the characters able to move towards a basis of reconstruction. And why is that? Is because each of the characters has challenged and thought about the social and cultural norms. And what is this, of course, reflective of? The ways in which various different philosophers have all thought about, of course, the norms in which we live under, as well as the structures of knowledge at the same time. And so, in the midst of all that, what does philosophy itself, or at least a lot of them all like to do, is from that basis of criticism, then seek to reconstruct a whole model that will seek to overcome these problems that they've identified. And so you have that, of course, in Descartes and the Meditations, and you have that with Husserl, who, inspired by Descartes as well, and is the father of the philosophical school called phenomenology. As we always have in philosophy, is all these posh terms for things. And so, we have this moment of pure creativity, but then what happens more or less immediately after that is all these various different characters worship a donkey. And then in the following section, we then have the Ass Festival, as it's called, which means, of course, the Donkey Festival, in which they're all celebrating and worshipping the donkey. And Zarathustra has this moment in which he says, what are you basically doing to every single character, or more or less every character, and wanting to make them snap out of it, basically. Make them realize what they're doing and their own stupidity for worshipping the donkey in the first place. And touching upon a couple of responses, we had the priest, who is the person that is seeking out the last pious person that still believes in God. And so the priest, or old pope as he's also called, then is happy just to have something to worship, and just loves that whole act of worshipping, and doesn't care that it's a donkey. And then another response was by the sorcerer as a character, in which we then had the sorcerer, who is a person that wants other people to love him, and doesn't have any belief or meaning for himself, but rather will say whatever it takes for people to love him. And then Zarathustra says to the sorcerer, how will you get other people to love you? And the sorcerer says back one of the most interesting replies, I know it's stupid, but I do it anyway. And of course, last episode, we touched much deeper upon this, about how people will still believe in something even if they don't actually believe in it. And so this then moves us on into this week's episode, where we have the characters at the end of the last section. Zarathustra's saying, come out of this cave, come out of this childlike understanding that you have of the world based upon worshipping deities. We need to become adults. We need to get out of this cave. We need to not think about entering into the kingdom of heaven, as he says, but rather into the kingdom of earth. And so we have then at the start of the Intoxicated song, with all the characters having come out of the cave, and this sort of breath of fresh air that they then have, and realize and sort of reflect upon their own actions just a little bit, and then come onto Zarathustra's side, and we have this sense of the characters then moving away from worshipping the donkey into a appreciation of the earth. And so, in itself, it's something that happens quite quickly, of course, but here we have almost a metaphor for how Nietzsche sees the movement of humanity and how human thought has moved, in which we have Nietzsche say, what did we have in the past and in past civilizations? Is this whole divine connection and divine relation into the world? Why is that? Because it's people trying to make sense of things as it occurred in the world. Why does certain things happen? And they then attributed all these various different actions to divine interventions, or controlled by divine beings. And of course, one of the easiest examples we can go back to is the Olympian gods, in which we have in ancient Greece. Why does lightning occur? Because that is controlled by Zeus. Who controls the oceans? That's Poseidon. What happens when we die? We go to the underworld, and that's controlled by Hades. And so we'll have all these various different gods and a polytheism there, all controlling various different occurrences in the world. And that gives us an explanation for why it happens. Of course, we can go to monotheism, we can go to Christianity, and instead of having multiple gods, we just have one supreme, all-powerful God in which that God is in control of everything and is the reason for why everything occurred in the world. And of course, Christianity, you only need to go into Genesis and the whole aspect of creation within 7 days and so on. So, why do we have this relation into divinities? Why are they created in the first place? Because they have a relation into people trying to make sense of and understand the world, and are an explanation for why things occur in the world. Then we move on in human thought through the development of the scientific understanding of the world. And of course, this is not something that just pops out of nowhere. We have within the divine context, of course, in ancient Greece, simultaneously the counter-narrative that people are also arguing for, that we need to have a basis not upon divine beings or gods, but rather we need to understand the world through human inquiry. And as a nice tie-in to the special episode in Parmenides, that's one of the ideas we have in Parmenides, pre-Socratic philosopher, as well as his teacher Xenophanes, who argues for those precise points, that the world is something that we need to understand through human inquiry and not based upon the actions of the gods. Then we have, of course, Aristotle, very much in relation to a early basis into scientific understanding of the world there as well. And through all that, in the midst of having this divine basis for things, we also have the counter-narrative arguing for human inquiry. And so, moving on into the Enlightenment period and so forth, we have the development of modern sciences, and which you have then the even greater emphasis upon understanding the world and various different models being created for how can we understand the world without a divine reason for why it occurs. So what is exactly all this getting at is that we've had within this moment just simply them moving out of the cave into the world is reflective precisely of this move in human history where people have an enclosed mind that is represented by the cave. As Nietzsche says, it's a childlike understanding. What happens when we move out of this cave? Our world is then opened up into a completely different understanding altogether. And if only we then come out of the cave, do we then realize, in fact, it's not based upon an enclosed space, but rather, actually, there's so many different possibilities. And of course, these different possibilities is just relation into the sciences, be it in relation to biology, chemistry, physics. And then we have, of course, that whole moment of moving away from that divine basis, away from wanting the kingdom of heaven into wanting the kingdom of earth again, as we said before. That whole idea of wanting to understand the world, love the world in such a way that we did in the previous historical sense of loving the divinities and loving divine beings. Now Nietzsche says here we have to have the shift around to now loving the earth in the same way. And interestingly enough here, there's a very subtle reference to Plato. And for people that's been listening to previous episodes, you know how much I love to slip in Plato every now and then to the discussion. Here, we have a really nice relation into Plato because of Plato's cave. And in a very brief discussion here of Plato's cave, it's simply the idea that in Plato, we have a metaphor for how his philosophy works. So in the cave, we have an example of prisoners who've remained chained up in the cave the entire time, all their lives, and all what they're able to see is reflections on the wall. And the argument goes, if one of them was released and was able to come out of the cave, they would be able to see the world as it is, and actually see that the shadows are actual objects in the world. And if the person went back into the cave to try to explain this to the people that are still chained up, they wouldn't believe the person who had gotten out. They, in fact, would still believe that the shadows were, in fact, the real objects. And so what is all this a metaphor for in Plato is the way in which he says, in fact, all the world is simply copies or shadows of an idea. And a good example for that is to say, how does someone create something in the first place? You need an idea for it. And this idea is something that's abstract, something that's existing out with an actual created object in the world, at least when we initially design something. And then once, of course, you bring it into the world, you need to make it work and potentially change it up and so forth. What is all this saying is that that's exactly how Plato understands the world. We have these ideas that he says are pure, and therefore everything that we try to do to bring them into the world will be tainting them in a way, will be modifying them, and therefore they're not as perfect as the idea that we have. And so, going back into the Nietzsche then, what's so interesting about the cave is that he twists it around. That on the one hand, we have in Plato this relation from the world into metaphysics, where, of course, being pure objects, and also the fact that Plato says that they're timeless as well, means that they're metaphysical. Whilst is Nietzsche's whole emphasis here is moving away from a metaphysical basis back into the world. And so what's so great about this is we have Plato's cave, but in the complete reverse situation. People are coming out into the cave, not understanding the world based upon a metaphysical basis, but rather upon the scientific one. So that's just really an interesting side note in how we can relate this cave back into Plato and how Nietzsche twists it around in the opposite way. So then, once we have the characters come out of the cave, we have the ugliest man make a speech. And the ugliest man says, "My assembled friends, what do you think? For the sake of this day, I am content for the first time to have lived my whole life. Was that life? I will say to death, very well, once more. And immediately what we have is a connection straight into one of Nietzsche's big concepts that's appeared only briefly before, is that of the eternal return. And so the ugliest man is saying, now I'm content, and to such an extent that, in fact, if I had to repeat my life, if I had to live my life over, I would say to death, very well, I will do that exact thing once more, please. And the whole thing about the eternal return is that we're going to develop it out in exactly what does this mean? What exactly does this mean for your life? Is it something that's only going to be thinking of the happy moments? Is it going to be something that's only going to be focused upon something that's pleasurable? Or rather, is the eternal return going to also bring all the problems back with it? And so these are questions that we'll be building upon as we go through the Intoxicated song, all in relation to the eternal return as a concept. Then in section two, it starts to precisely go down into this whole idea of night. And we have Zarathustra hear this bell that's signaling precisely that night is coming. And so, what exactly is this whole relation into night going on about? Is that we've had quite a frequent relation all into the idea of noontide, which is simply to say noontide is midday in such a way that it's the point in which the sun's going to come up to its highest point, going to shine its brightest in midday. What exactly is this a metaphor for? Is the way in which Nietzsche sees the relationship into knowledge that will eventually move towards a noontide. And why is it moving towards the noontide? Is that we'll overcome all the problems of his current time period that he sees. What are some of the problems? Is pessimism and this overall nihilistic outlook, and we'll move forward on from there. And interestingly enough, this section at noontide relates quite nicely into this section because it deals also with the idea of happiness and living your life. And what does it mean to have lived a life? In which we had back in the section for at noontide, the answer to that was happiness is the little things in life that initially we think it's something that's unattainable or that only a few people can attain it. But in fact, what's argued is it happens on such a frequent basis that we in fact miss it. It's all those little moments. And a good example of that, of course, would be just having a really nice cup of tea. That's just a little thing, of course, that we can take for granted every day. Or having just a really nice meal that we just feel really great afterwards for having eaten. And just so a couple of little things in which you can say, those are the things that make life great. Those just little novel things that otherwise we take for granted. That's what makes us happy. And it doesn't have to be this big thing like the idea of heaven, where precisely only a few people would ever attain the idea of it, or you'd have to belong to, of course, the Christian religion to achieve happiness in the first place in that given context. But Nietzsche here argues precisely the opposite. Everybody can achieve happiness. In fact, everybody does so on a daily basis. So we take this idea of happiness, and then we're starting to move towards the night and this mysterious bell that keeps ringing. And Zarathustra is saying, come, come, I hear this bell. Everybody follow me. And so let's move on then into the next few sections. Section 3. You hire men. Midnight is coming on. So I'll say something in your ears. As that old bell says it in my ear. As secretly, as fearfully, as warmly as that midnight bell tells it to me, which has experienced more than one man, which has already counted your father's painful heartbeats. Ah, ah, how it sighs, how in dreams it laughs, the ancient, deep, deep midnight. Soft, soft. Then many a thing can be heard which may not speak by day. But now in the cool air, when all the clamor of your hearts too has grown still, now it speaks, now it is heard, now it creeps into nocturnal, over wakeful souls. Ah, ah, how it sighs, how in dreams it laughs. Do you not hear how secretly, fearfully, warmly it speaks to you, the ancient, deep, deep midnight? O man, attend. Section 4. Woe is me! Where has time fled? Did I not sink into deep wells? The world is asleep. Ah, ah. The dog howls. The moon is shining. I will rather die, die than tell you what my midnight heart is now thinking. Now I am dead. It is finished. Spider, why do you spin your web around me? Do you want blood? Ah, ah. The dew is falling. The hour has come. The hour which chills and freezes me, which asks and asks and asks, who has heart enough for it? Who shall be master of the world? Who will say, thus shall you run, you great and small streams? The hour approaches, O man, you higher men, attend. This discourse is for delicate ears. For your ears, what does deep midnight's voice contend? Section 5. I am borne away. My soul dances. The day's task. The day's task. Who will be master of the world? The moon is cool. The wind falls silent. Ah, ah. Have you flown high enough? You dance, but a leg is not a wing. You good dancers, now all joy is over. Wine has become dregs. Every cup has grown brittle. The graves mutter. You have not flown high enough. Now the graves mutter. Redeem the dead. Why is it night so long? Does the moon not intoxicate us? You higher men, redeem the graves, awaken the corpses. Alas, why does the worm still burrow? The hour approaches, it approaches. The bell booms, the heart still drones, the woodworm, the heart's worm still burrows. Alas, the world is deep. Section 6. Sweet lyre, your sound, your intoxicated, ominous sound delights me. From how long ago, from how far away, does your sound come to me? From a far distance, from the pools of love. You ancient bell, you sweet lyre, every pain has torn at your heart. The pain of a father, the pain of our fathers, the pain of our forefathers. Your speech has grown ripe, ripe like golden autumn and afternoon, like my hermit's heart. Now you say, the world itself has grown ripe. The grapes grow brown. Now they want to die. To die. To die of happiness. You higher man, do you not smell it? An odor is secretly welling up. A secret and odor of eternity. An odor of roseate bliss. A brown, golden wine odor of ancient happiness. Of intoxicated midnight's dying happiness, which sings. The world is deep, deeper than day can comprehend. Sections 3-6, then. We have quite a strange picture that's starting to be painted when we go into these sections. We have the whole idea of night, and precisely midnight, and then all this sort of darkness and kind of slightly horror and unsettling image, let's say, that's painted here. Something to not make you comfortable with. Like, as it says there in section 4, spider, why do you spin your web around me? Do you want blood? And it's sort of like, that's rather interesting. Why is he suddenly saying about spiders? And then we can go into section 5 when he's talking about dancing's all finished now, joy is all over, redeem the dead and awaken the corpses. And so suddenly then we have the idea potentially of zombies as well come out. We have these creepy spiders lurking. We have people digging up corpses. We have the idea in section 6 of the world itself grown ripe and the world itself dying in this sort of post-apocalyptic style of image. And so we have all these various different sort of unsettling images as we go through sections 3-6. And it takes a good think to really reflect upon exactly what Nietzsche's saying here, to get past these images and to try to think about exactly what are they metaphors for? What are all these images really saying? And what we can build upon is what it said already for the ugliest man. And I think it's important that it's the ugliest man that said this as well, because that character is called also the murderer of God, and Zarathustra finds him incredibly repulsive because he's a murderer, as we, of course, all would find murderers repulsive. And so we have this idea of I'm happy and content for the first time in my life, from the ugliest man. And of course, we can think upon trying to achieve contentment in our life is something that's incredibly positive for us. That, in fact, we've reached a moment of being happy. So, for example, we could say perhaps someone had a really nasty breakup and then it took them a long time to get over the loss of that person. They found contentment and joy back in their life again. And of course, the idea of contentment there is very positive. But what Nietzsche is starting to pick at the problems of is the idea of contentment is something that is going to always be a thing that's going to be the same over time. And the problem that he wants to start to pick at is only having one idea of happiness. That, in fact, what we're going to be content with is something that doesn't have to be, of course, big or small. It could be the little things, as it said before. But the problem that he starts to pick away at here is when we precisely don't engage with things anymore and don't reflect upon things, don't critically engage with them. We're just suddenly back in this sort of herd mentality state again, in which we're just simply content to chew the grass like the cows and the sheep in the fields, and we're just simply happy and content in that state. That's the state that he doesn't want us to always be in. Of course, not to be in this constant critical state all the time, but just simply to be aware of the pitfalls that we can always go back into this herd-like mentality, taking everything at face value. So building upon this as an idea then, we have the relation into a golden wine odor of ancient happiness, as he says, in section 6. So, what is this problem, the idea of sameness and contentment? Is to pick upon the problems with, as he says, an ancient idea of what happiness is at the same time. Because we have within the Christian religion, the idea of happiness, of course, is not achievable in this life whatsoever. In fact, what should we do? Live our lives in a good way now, so that in fact we'll achieve happiness in the afterlife. And that is one of the dangers in which Nietzsche's also aware of, is that our idea of contentment and of happiness in itself is dangerous because we can push it to such an extreme that we in fact don't find any happiness in this life, in the here and now. And that's what he doesn't want. And so that's where we start to get into the understanding of this whole relation to night and zombies and the world dying, because here Nietzsche's ultimately saying, from a novel idea of happiness in which one person has a specific idea of what they find happy, they suddenly then could become popular, they become a celebrity, they gain a cult following, and suddenly something that was initially novel then takes upon immense burden, immense meaning, and value. And from all that as well, you have various different competing ideas of what happiness is. And it doesn't have to be in the religious context, of course. Epicurus is someone who's popped up before in previous episodes, where Epicureanism, of course, has the misunderstanding that it's in fact about joy of indulgence, when in fact Epicureanism's all about simplicity and only having a joy in what we find is natural and necessary for us, and away from things that's unnecessary. And just very briefly to go over that, what Epicurus sees as natural and necessary is all the basic things that we'd have is water and food. And what he sees in terms of food as natural and necessary is a vegetarian diet because he sees meat as an unnecessary luxury. And then he also applies that to houses and living, in which having more rooms than you need is unnecessary. Let's say a library or a game room. He would argue you don't need. Those are two unnecessary luxuries, perhaps, for people. And so we have then this whole idea as well of zombies come in to fit into this idea of a cult mentality that can be made. That, in fact, what we're doing in this given context is digging up the graves of the past and past ideas, past people, and the ways in which we've again worshipped and believed in the past. And again, it's coming back into here how people have worshipped various different gods also then applies to how we in a contemporary society worship pop idols and celebrities. And in the same given context here, when it comes down to our lifestyle and what we find that's going to make us happy, then we're going to also worship certain people. But what we're doing in that given context, that Nietzsche says, is that you're following precisely those people in the past that also worshipped people like Epicurus, or in religious contexts, various different religious organizations, the exact same mentality there, because you're latching onto specifically an idea of what happiness is. And then, of course, Nietzsche pushes it to the extreme. When you have such a love for a specific person and what their idea of happiness is, he's going to be extremely critical of it. Why? Because he wants us, of course, to achieve our own forms of happiness, our own ways in which we can make ourselves happy, and not for everybody to all latch upon to the same idea. What does this idea of sameness do? Kill everything. Why? Is because it denies all those different perspectives, denies all the little novel differences that we have between what we do like and what we don't like from each other. And suddenly, if everything was the same, think about the absolute hell of existence, if that was the case. And that hell of the sameness, that everybody would have to like the same things, that everybody would be more or less a clone of everybody else. And so we just ultimately walk around liking and disliking exactly the same things. How boring of a life would that be if we couldn't have all the differences and dislikes and likes that we could possibly have? That's the ways in which we can start to fight back against this nightmarish images that Nietzsche's given to us, and to fight back against this sort of horrific image in which the world is dying that we're left with in section 6. So, as time's getting on in this episode, we better wrap up for there. So we've had then, in sections 1 to 6, this whole idea of all the different characters come out of the cave, get a breath of fresh air, and appreciate Zarathustra's view, and have a love of the earth, in which then we have this whole relation into what Nietzsche says about human thought. We've moved from the divine foundation, basing upon our understanding of the world upon gods, to now moving towards an appreciation of the earth and a much more scientific understanding. Then from that, we have the ugliest man say that he is, at the first time, content in his life, and then from that, starting to problematize this idea of contentment and happiness, that precisely we don't want it always to be the same, but rather we want all to appreciate our individual ideas of happiness. In the next episode, we'll be continuing on reading through the Intoxicated Song into sections 7 to 12. Many thanks for listening to the episode. Feel free to check out my Patreon page at patreon.com/dissectingphilosophy. Drop me an email at my address, dissectingphilosophy@gmail.com. Tip me a coffee at ko-fi.com/dissectingphilosophy. And lastly, I can be found on Twitter at IamARubberMan. Many thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me next time.